to Measuring Success Right, the official podcast of the Marriott Student Review, where we connect the leaders of tomorrow with the issues of today.
I think the first thing you've got to do is stop competing with other people. The best success is to be happy.
Welcome to a new episode of Measuring Success Right. My name is Hunter Muse, and I'll be co-hosting today.
My name is Jenny Beth Stenquist. I'm a marketing major in the business school here at BYU.
And we are thrilled to welcome our guest today, Dean Bridget Madrian. Dean Madrian, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure to be here with you both.
Thanks.
Yes, Bridget Madrian is the Dean and Marriott Distinguished Professor in the Brigham Young University Marriott School of Business, where she has a joint appointment in the Department of Finance and the George W. Romney Institute of Public Service and Ethics. Before coming to BYU, she was on the faculty at Harvard Kennedy School, the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School, the University of Chicago Graduate School of Business, and the Harvard University Economics Department. She is also a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research and served as co-director of the NBER Household Finance Working Group from 2010 to 2018.
Dr. Madrian's current research focuses on behavioral economics and household finance, with a particular focus on household saving and investment behavior. Her work in this area has impacted the design of employer-sponsored savings plans in the U.S. and has influenced pension reform legislation, both in the U.S. and abroad. She also uses the lens of behavioral economics to understand health behaviors and improve health outcomes. Dr. Madrian received her PhD in economics from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and studied economics as an undergraduate here at Brigham Young University. She is a recipient of the Retirement Income and Industry Association Achievement in Applied Retirement Research Award. That is a mouthful. That's got to be an awesome award. And a three-time recipient of the TIAA Paul A. Samuelson Award for Scholarly Research on Lifelong Financial Security. Dean Madrian, thanks so much for taking some time out to be with us.
It's exciting to be here.
So tell us, how's it being dean? How's your first year going? What have you learned? Tell us about that experience.
So this has been a big switch for me. I moved institutions, moved from the Harvard Kennedy School to the Brigham Young University Marriott School of Business, and that involved moving from Boston to Utah, and it also involved moving from being a faculty member to being an administrator. So that's a lot of changes all at once, but so far it has been an amazing experience. One of the things that I'm really enjoying is having a new set of challenges and having to learn some new skills. So being a professor involves getting really good at a certain specific set of things. And being a good administrator and a good leader involves having to learn some other new skills. Yeah. And, there have been some challenges, but I'm having fun learning and growing, developing. That's one of the things that really drew me to being an academic in the first place, was that I would always get to keep on learning new things. And this is a job transition that is allowing me to do that.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I love that. Could you speak to some of those skills that you mentioned? Like, what skills are different as an administrator rather than, just a faculty member?
So as an administrator, you have to make decisions. You have to set the strategic vision for the institution you're leading. Sometimes you have to have difficult conversations, and they're at a different level than the difficult conversations you have to have as a faculty member. So as a faculty member, I had to deal with students who would come in and they're disappointed in their grade or have a complaint about a class. And those are hard conversations, but the difficult conversations you have to have as a higher level administrator are just different. I can't really go into detail about, about some of those there. So that's one of the challenges, and I've had to learn how to think about what you want to say in those situations and what you don't want to say, and the importance of thinking them through, and maybe even talking to someone beforehand. That's been really valuable. It's also really exciting to be in a position where you can try and direct the mission of an organization and then try and marshal the resources, the personnel that you have, the members of your team, and financial resources, and you know, forge partnerships and try and push new initiatives forward in a different way. And that's been really exciting. And then working with the students is always a lot of fun.
What are some of those initiatives that you're looking forward to make happen?
That is an excellent question. Trying to decide how much of that I can actually reveal here in this podcast.
Oh, sure.
We have some plans for how we might better serve the student population on campus. One of the initiatives we're undertaking right now is revamping our business minor as a way to give more students who are majoring in other things on campus the type of training that might help them be more successful when they transition from being a student into a job, which is going to be in the business world, so that even if they don't want to major in business, they have a subset at least of the skills that they might need to be more successful. So we've been talking to different deans and department chairs and advisors across campus on what are the set of skills that would help a student majoring in humanities or majoring in fine arts or majoring in life sciences. What are the types of skills that those students would need? And then we're the business school, so we can teach those classes and serve more students. We're also thinking about ways that we can expand the number of undergraduate students who can major in business, because we're turning away students who apply to our programs every year because we don't have the capacity. So we're trying to think strategically about how we could do that. We're developing an international online MBA for students who live in other countries, so they can get a BYU Marriott MBA without having to actually quit their job and uproot their families and move to Provo for 2 years. That'll be exciting. We're trying to think about what we can do to make a mark in the world with respect to business ethics and integrity. The business school is housed in the Tanner Building, named after N. Eldon Tanner, and his moniker when he was alive was Mr. Integrity. And I think that's a part of what Brigham Young University is as an institution, is we believe one of our, you know, one of the missions and aims is to be a character building place and also a place where education leads to lifelong learning and service. And so we're trying to think about how we can both make sure that we're training our students to be leaders of integrity, but also how we can help spread that message outside the university as well, to our alumni, to people who don't even have any connections with BYU, by taking a strong position on that and helping facilitate those conversations elsewhere. Those are a few of the things. Some of them are going to require some approval. So we're hoping that we'll, you know, get the appropriate approvals that we need to move forward. But I'm excited about what the BYU Marriott School might be doing 5 or 10 years down the road.
Right. That's incredibly exciting. And it sounds like you have a lot on your plate right now. So
better busy than bored.
Hey, amen. We read your bio, and as I was kind of reading it, I was just kind of amazed at the sheer productivity that you've had throughout your career, and your ability to just produce, and you've done so much in academia, and now as a leader in the Marriott School of Business. Kind of what led you to choose this career path? Did you have any idea, you know, when you were in our positions, you know, and at BYU, that you wanted this path? Like, how did that shape for you?
Well, I was a little bit of an unusual child. I can remember the moment in time when I was sitting in my eighth grade math class and I decided that I was going to get a PhD and become a professor. Now, I didn't know of what. I didn't know what I was going to get a PhD in or what I wanted to be a professor of, but I can remember distinctly sitting in that class and deciding, this is what I want to be when I grow up.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think it came out of the blue. My father was a sociology professor here at BYU when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. So I spent a lot of time on campus and I thought his job looked pretty good. And so that's what I decided I wanted to do. And then my first semester as a freshman at BYU, I took an economics class and I absolutely fell in love with it. Mm. And so by the end of that first semester, I decided, okay, I'm going to major in economics and I'm going to get a PhD in economics and then I'm going to go be an economics professor.
Wow.
And the great thing about having that clarity from almost day one in college was that I was able to take classes and be really intentional about how I was spending my time to make that goal of mine become a reality so that when I graduated, I had the background I needed to do well in graduate school.
Yeah, that's amazing.
I love that. Sounds like you're a long-term goal planner. I love that. And it seems like that's contributed a lot to your research, which has been far and wide. What are some of the most impactful projects that you've worked on and why would you consider them impactful?
So one of the things that I've really enjoyed in my research career has been the opportunity to do research on important public policy problems, because those are the types of things that interest me. And then having that research actually have an impact on real world outcomes. So there are, I think, two specific research projects that I'm particularly proud of having worked on. So the first is my dissertation when I was in graduate school examined the link between health insurance in the U.S. and labor market outcomes. So in contrast to many other countries that have more of a nationalized health insurance system, in the U.S., most people who aren't retired get health insurance coverage through their employer or a family member's employer. And my dissertation documented that this actually leads to distortions in people's decisions about whether to work, how much to work, and where to work. So I documented, for example, that people are much less likely to change jobs if there's a risk that they might lose their health insurance coverage. So a married man is less likely to change jobs if his wife isn't working than if his wife is working and his wife has health insurance coverage.
Interesting.
And those effects are large. So that eventually helped inform part of the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act of 1996, which had a provision in it to make it easier for people to take their health insurance coverage with them when they changed jobs. So it was exciting to work on something that had an impact. Then a few years later, I wrote a paper which showed that when employers automatically enroll employees into their retirement savings plan, their 401k plan would be the most popular variety, the fraction of people who are saving can be almost 50 percentage points higher than if you make the plan available and people have to sign up on their own. So no changes in the plan, just change in what you have to do to be in the plan. Do you have to actively sign up for it? Or do we automatically put you in and if you don't want to be there, you have to actively disenroll yourself? And that particular paper has been the basis for pension reform legislation in the U.S., major overhaul in the U.K. that's increased the fraction of people saving in the U.K. by almost 30 percentage points. It's now forming the basis of a number of state-level reforms in the U.S. to increase retirement savings plan participation at the state level. And it's been exciting to do something that has an impact and helps improve people's lives and you know, that it's influenced tens, maybe hundreds of millions of people across the world. That's really that's really fulfilling.
Yeah, I'm sure.
That's incredible. I talked to some other students on BYU campus
and told him that you were going to be on our show. And I was like, what would you want to talk with Dean Majorian about if you had the chance? What would you want to ask her? And we had a variety of responses, and hopefully we'll get through a few of them today. But one of the most pronounced was definitely people wanting to know your viewpoint on your balancing your work and balancing your family and your different obligations that are pulling on your attention constantly, I imagine. We'd love to hear about how you manage that and what's your philosophy.
Yeah, great question. So let me make a couple of points in answering that question. So the first one is that life involves making compromises. If someone tries to tell you you can have it all, they are lying to you. You can't have it all. You have to make choices, and those choices involve trade-offs. And there are definitely trade-offs in working and trying to have a family at the same time. But for me, I decided that I really liked my job, and I got a lot of personal fulfillment out of doing that, and I was willing to give up some other things. So I gave up reading the newspaper. I gave up going to book club every month. I gave up my movie night that I had with friends so that I could both do my job, which was important to me, and be a mother, which was also important to me. Being an academic, it turns out, is, I think, a great job for balancing work and family, because although there are obligations that you have to show up for, like teaching class, there is a fair amount of unstructured time. So there are things you need to get done, but in terms of preparing lectures and grading assignments and exams and things like that, there's a lot of flexibility in terms of when you do those and where you do those. So being an academic for me was a great occupation that allowed me to juggle things in a way that didn't feel like it was so much of a sacrifice. So if a child was sick and I needed to stay home, if I wasn't teaching that day, it was really easy to do. Or if I needed to go to a parent-teacher conference or go chaperone a field trip, and I could make up for the time I wasn't spending in the workday later on at night or on the weekend or something like that. And then I guess the last thing is, by working and having my husband also work, we had a higher level of income. And so we used some of that income to buy more help around the household. So there was a point in time where we had a nanny who was taking care of our kids after school. And we also had her fixing dinner 3 or 4 nights a week. And that was great because I could come home, and that was one thing I didn't have to worry about, was fixing dinner. Now that my kids are in college, I have to fix dinner.
Right. It's those compromises that you talked about. I think that's such a great point. And I love, you know, how you've talked about those trade-offs that we have to kind of make as, you know, as business students, as aspiring young professionals. What advice specifically do you have for aspiring business women?
I think my most important piece of advice would be, don't let your own doubts about what you can do or what you can accomplish or what others will think of you deter you from going after your dream. I think women have a tendency to think too much about what other people will think about them. And oftentimes they're completely off base. They're assuming that other people are judging them in a way that simply isn't true. And I think sometimes women are afraid to put themselves out there, to voice their opinion, to apply for a job that they really want, even if on paper it might not look like they're completely qualified. There's a lot of interesting research on gender differences and how women and men make decisions in the workplace. So One study showed that if you have a job description and it has, let's say, 10 things that the employer would really like to have in their ideal candidate, that women will look at that and they'll only apply if they satisfy all 10 or 9 out of 10 of those things. And a male candidate will look at that same list and say, hey, I've done 3 of those. I am perfectly well qualified for that job. And so I think women have a tendency to sell themselves short. Mm-hmm. So my advice would be, go for it. Don't stand in the way between you and your dreams.
I love that. Not shying away from something that could be from fulfilling your potential. Love that.
I had a conversation with someone this past week, and I was talking about being on the podcast with you, and they had this question they wanted to ask you. Basically, when we're at school and we're at work, we're constantly in this competition for attention on, you know, our GPAs and, you know, the next job interview and, you know, keeping up with the competition maybe that's in our majors and that we feel as we go about our lives. How can we make space for lifelong learning and service in the midst of these like pressures and tensions?
Great question. Really deep and profound question.
Yeah.
I think the first thing you've got to do is stop competing with other people. Mm-hmm. Competing with other people is essentially a way of defining yourself by where you are relative to someone else. And in the grand scheme of things, that's not really what matters. What matters is competing with yourself. Are you being a better person? Are you doing what is most important and what you value most in terms of the choices you're making and how you're spending your time? And I think this is a huge problem on every college campus. And it creates, I think it feeds into a lot of the behavioral and mental health challenges that we see with many of our students is, I don't know why, but students have some view of what success looks like, and they're trying to follow a model that someone else has prescribed for them, not realizing that the goal they should be having is not how can I succeed, but how can I be happy? Hmm. That the best success is to be happy. And there are lots of different ways to be happy. And when you're trying to find a job or trying to pick a major, it's a lot easier to be happy if you pick something that you like doing and that's a good fit for your skills and your interests. Mm. And just because your roommate or your classmate wants this particular job or is majoring this particular thing and is happy at it, that doesn't mean you're going to be happy at it. Mm-hmm. You need to figure out what's going to make you happy instead of absolving yourself of the responsibility of figuring that out and just following what everyone else is doing. And I think if you can really be true to yourself and figure out what will make you happy, you won't be competing with others anymore. You'll be competing with yourself. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah, I love that. When just playing off of your answer there, how did you figure out what made you happy and what really does make you happy?
I think I'm still trying to figure out what makes me happy.
Aren't we all?
I like being intellectually challenged. So that's one mm-hmm. of the things that made being an academic an attractive job for me. I think there are some things that I think initially I was afraid of, but that I've learned over time that if I can overcome those fears, I can actually be happy in a different way. So I'm an introvert. That surprises a bunch of people, but I am. I'm an introvert. When I was younger, you know, I didn't really like going to parties and being in large group gatherings. It didn't bring me joy. It brought me a lot of anxiety. And over time, I've pushed myself intentionally because I knew that this was holding me back from certain things, pushed myself to become more comfortable doing those things. And it's one of the things that has, I think, allowed me to move from being a faculty member to an administrator. I spent a lot of time talking to people that I don't know and going to big events where I have to work the room, for lack of a better phrase. And those are all things that 20, 25, 30 years ago would have made me really uncomfortable and anxious and unhappy. But now I enjoy it because it's something that I worked on. I was competing with myself, right? This is something that I need to get better at, and I'm willing to work on it, and I can understand why this might be useful.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. Boy, I wish we had so much more time. I feel like I've just learned so much in our conversation. We'll have to do this again, hopefully sometime. We'd love to hear more from you. I guess before we wrap up, one question we like to ask our guests before they go is, how can the leaders of tomorrow prepare today?
If you want to be a leader of the future, be intentional about what it will take to get from where you are today to where you want to be down the road. And that means making decisions about how to spend your time. That means making decisions about what kind of skills you need to acquire that you might not already have. It means recognizing where your weaknesses are so that you can, you know, part of being a leader is usually working as part of a team. So you can get skills around working with a team and working with people who have different strengths than you and also have different weaknesses. I think being a successful leader requires having a decent amount of humility. That the leaders who really make a difference in the world are the leaders who aren't doing it for themselves, but they're the leaders who are put in a position of leading something where they're passionate about helping other people achieve their goals and bringing out the best in other people. So learning how to put your own ego aside and find joy in helping other people. I think those are all things that would be good advice for anyone who's aspiring to be a leader in the future.
Yeah.
I love that.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Dean Madrian. We're so glad you could take some time to spend some time with us. Make sure you subscribe to our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, or SoundCloud so you never miss an episode. Be a friend and tell a friend about Measuring Success Right.
This podcast is a project of the Marriott Student Review at Brigham Young University. You can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Marriott Student Review or online at marriottstudentreview.org.